As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Welcome to The Game, the podcast that always picks a team to win, whoever the opposition is. Today I'm joined by Alison Rudd, Paddy Barclay, and from the great northeast of England, the man with five cats, it's George Culkin. Later on we'll be discussing football men versus businessmen in the boardroom, but let's start with the action from the weekend. Now, we're going to start at Anfield, and I want to say something clearly now in Sir Alex's defense before we start. In a match of the day when all giggly, oh, the biggest game in the world, eh? Ha, ha, ha. And like, oh, look, ha, ha, ha. You know, he's losing it. I looked through all his quotes. I couldn't find him actually saying that Liverpool against Manchester United was the biggest game in the world. All I found was him saying it's the biggest game in the English calendar, which I think you'd have to be kind of mad to argue that it's not. Has anybody actually heard the man?
The biggest game in English. No, to clear that up, I never heard him say that. But besides, why would you listen? I mean, the biggest match in the world is quite obviously Real Madrid against Barcelona. Yeah. Even when they play a preseason friendly, it's the biggest. It feels like bigger than the World Cup. So, I mean, you couldn't compare any England game with Real Madrid Barcelona.
Okay, so nobody here actually heard him ever say that, right?
No, they didn't.
So why did we just kind of take it as read? Is it a case that, like, you know, somebody mentions some untruth and then we just go on and on with it?
Well,
it sounds good. Like, oh, look, Fergie's gone mad. He said it's bigger than Barca Real Madrid. Is that what we're doing?
If he says it's the biggest game in the English calendar, then right. People in football who promote football and screen football automatically assume that means the world, because we're very self-centered, aren't we?
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, but it's okay.
I mean, more when in doubt.
I mean, I'm sure Ferguson would never be deliberately mischievous, but I mean, he's got a much bigger game coming up this Sunday than he had last Saturday, that's for sure.
Surely does. Now, George, the game, obviously, it finished 1-1, but struck me most of all was what I thought was a really bizarre lineup, especially after you've sort of bigged up the match so much. You go out there and you play without your best player, without last season's top goal scorer, but of course we're sort of used to that, without the guy who was probably your best performance last year, without Valencia, who made it seem as if, you know, last year when he got injured, it made it seem like as if the sky was falling, without Vidic, who was fit enough to play 90 minutes last week, or 90 minutes for Serbia midweek, I should say, and without Hernandez. We're all for rotation, but were you somewhat miffed?
Well, I suppose it's the difference between what Ferguson allegedly did or did not say about the game, and that's about the emotion of the game, I suppose, as opposed to perhaps the place it has in terms of, you know, the league and who's going to win the title. I mean, because as you say, next Sunday's games against Man City is far more pivotal to that, and of course they've got the Champions League in midweek, so there has to be a sort of form of rotation. Mancini, I was at Man City, and Mancini did something similar. It's not the same kind of game, but you know, he took lots of players out of the firing line to sort of prepare for the week ahead. So I think, yes, maybe that game is huge in terms of the emotion, in terms of the history and tradition and the sort of dislike between the two clubs, but in terms of what it actually means at the top of the table, it's a different matter.
Paddy, you followed Sir Alex just a little bit. You might have even written a book or two about him. Mm-hmm. Football Bloody Hell by Paddy Barclay. There you go.
Thank you very much.
There's your plug. But on the back of what George says, though, normally when you rotate, you know, the conventional way of doing it is to play your best players, the ones who can give you a chance to win, you know, on the Saturday. Then on Tuesday, you're playing a team from Romania, Otolu Galati, who, you know, yes, United didn't start very well, but you would think that if you are going to rotate, that's the time to do it, and then you get the guys back fresh again for the weekend.
Well, I agree, but I mean, Ferguson's the best rotator. I think he's the best coach in the world at changing his team, you know, at rotating. So that's the first thing that's got to be said. He understood squad rotation before any other coach in the world, in my opinion. That said, I thought Saturday's selection was all about fear of Liverpool. I mean, often last season when they won the title, Manchester United played without one holding midfield player. On Saturday they played two, and I think that was out of respect for Liverpool. I think he was...
You might even say four if you include Giggs and Park, given what they did.
Well, given their role in the team, it was a very defensive selection, but the result against you know, a Liverpool team who are strong at home, I think the result bore it out. I think that was a pretty good score. And I mean, it was interesting that he played. I mean, Phil Jones, could you imagine buying a teenage boy and playing him in three different positions in four games for your team? You know,
I mean,
starting him in three different positions. I mean, that's a remarkable tribute to him. I think you saw that he's raw technically in midfield. I think this Phil Jones area is getting a wee bit out of hand.
You're out of the Duncan Edwards bandwagon.
Don't even mention those two words in the context of Phil Jones. But anyway, I think that tactically it was born out by playing what was a defensive lineup and getting a decent result.
Well, it was pragmatic, wasn't it? I mean, he'd lost three games on the spin at Anfield. I think he thought...
People say that, but do you really think it goes into his mind, what happened 3 years ago when he had a different set of players and Rafa Benitez was there?
Not on that minute, but I think he knows Liverpool lift their game for against Man United at Anfield. He knows it's in a bubble. And he just thought, well, I think he was going for the draw. I think he got what he went for, actually. Yeah. And so, he'd probably be really chuffed. I think the really interesting bit about the selection is keeping Rooney on the bench for so long. Because I agree with Paddy, you can't argue with the genius of Ferguson. And I just wonder if Ferguson is one person in the country who doesn't rate Rooney quite as highly as most of us.
Okay, then, well, I'd respectfully say he'd be wrong if he doesn't rate him highly, but that's just me. Alison, I'm going to get you on Liverpool because Steven Gerrard came back. Some of us were wondering about how he'd fit in, and we saw that at least for this game, the way he fits in is Jordan Henderson goes out and Andy Carroll stays on the bench. What did you make of it, and is this something we're going to see again, or is Kenny going to rejigger it to find sort of the right balance for Gerrard?
I don't think it's about the right balance for Gerrard. I thought when they signed Charlie Adam, there was a feeling that Charlie Adam might sort of slowly disappear as Gerrard came back to full fitness. I think what it showed on Saturday was that Charlie Adam and Steven Gerrard can play together, and If anything, probably that was one of the best games Charlie Adams had. I thought he was man of the match. I thought he was absolutely superb.
Certainly was.
And I think they complement each other very well. I don't think Andy Carroll not being on the pitch had very much to do with Steven Gerrard, actually.
Paddy, would you like to express a view on the balance and what Liverpool might look like?
The thing about Andy Carroll is he will figure, because Suarez is about to hit the wall. It's inevitable. There are certain players who can play year-round. Cristiano Ronaldo is the best example I've ever come across. But I think it is very difficult. He's had he's joined a new club and been fantastically successful, put in tremendous energy. He's played more or less all through the summer. I doubt if he's even had a fortnight's holiday because of the Copa America.
Did you see signs that he was tiring on Saturday?
Yes.
Because there were moments when I thought, ooh, I was expecting him to just explode, and he didn't.
You know the turn. Actually, the shimmy in the box and the shot. I mean, that was. It was in a way. It was. I mean, it wasn't as difficult a save as all of that. I mean, I just. It's difficult because he set such a high standard, Suarez. But what with the getting involved with Evra, and I don't know about the details of that.
We'll get to that.
Okay. But getting involved with Evra, all that kind of stuff. He's a high-octane player, as we saw even in the World Cup, where he got into controversy there. But it will happen. He will have to be left out for his own good, or he'll get an injury. And then Carroll will certainly come into his own.
George, I'm trying to get these sort of soft London-based biased Southern scribes to talk about Andy Carroll. Instead, one of them talks about Gerrard in her answer, and the other one goes on and on about Luis Suarez. Can you give me some Carroll? And I want to know, against this crummy Manchester United defense, with Rio Ferdinand, who's clearly not himself right now, with Johnny Evans, might that have been something that Dalglish might have turned to? He only made one substitution in the game, that was Henderson. It's from what you've seen of the guy, is he bound to get annoyed at some point that he's not playing?
Possibly. I mean, obviously he's a Tyneside lad, so, and with Tyneside being Tyneside, I still get to sort of hear quite a lot about him and what he's doing and all that sort of stuff. And I mean, it's fair to say that Liverpool haven't got the best out of him, but I think it's also fair to say that he's still in a position in his life where he needs to kind of get himself fully focused and fully committed to. There's no doubt that on form he's an absolute monster of a footballer. It does entail sort of building a team up, if not around him, then certainly sort of adapting to his style because of what he offers. I mean, there's far more to him than aerial ability, but that's kind of a big part of it. And I don't think Liverpool have kind of played to that strength. And I think it's also fair to say that he hasn't pushed himself on the scene forcefully enough. I mean, I actually think that Gerrard coming back into the team in the long run will probably help Carroll, because if there's anybody that can kind of run onto his delivery or benefit from that, it will be Carroll. But I think, you know, he's still a work in progress, and I think he's still got to prove off the pitch that being a professional footballer is what he wants to do.
Paddy, I want to ask you about De Gea, because I get bombarded by people on Twitter asking me, make sure you ask Paddy, what does he think of De Gea now? Is he still Gomez without the shot stopping?
That's exactly right. Yeah, no, he's not. He's not Gomez without the shot stopping now. I mean, his shot stopping's absolutely superb. He's,
is he winning you over, I guess?
Of course he is. It's an interesting thing, actually. Football reporters do. They, when a chap's playing badly, they express it, and if he's playing well, they express it. I mean, I can't see what the issue is here. However, De Gea is an interesting thing, because he's a part of a phenomenon which began, in my opinion, with Fabian Barthez. The goalkeepers are getting younger. And that's not just because I'm getting older. De Gea's a good example. Iker Casillas was playing in the Champions League brilliantly as a teenager. De Gea now is well on the way to proving himself at Manchester United. I still feel sorry for Lindegaard, who may well be just as good a keeper. But De Gea's, proven himself in at the top level with Manchester United at the age of 20. This never happened before in my lifetime.
I think that might make a great subject for a bonus podcast soon. Sure. I might throw Gigi Buffon in there too.
Okay,
who's a world champion, unlike all those people you mentioned, except for Casillas.
But I did get the impression that the Liverpool dressing room, they thought about testing the keeper, and I think that backfired slightly. Yeah. And I think we are now all know that you don't go into a game against Man United thinking, oh, all we have to do is test the keeper.
All you have to do is shoot from the halfway line.
It's only Gerrard's allowed to do that. Now, I wanted to go on to the other incident that's been drawing a lot of attention. Unlike, no, I won't say that. I want to go on to the other incident that's been drawing a lot of attention. The FA have opened or are making an inquiry into the accusations that Patrice Evra leveled at Luis Suarez on Saturday on French television. This was then repeated to the referee, Andre Mariner, who I presume at some point will be at least addressing the point in his report. George, I want to start with you. This is something that is, I guess you could say, is rare, or we're giving the impression it's rare. It's if it did happen, it happens too often. But I'm curious, how can they? How do you think the FA can investigate this? I mean, unless a witness comes forward or Suarez admits it.
Yeah, and he's already denied it pretty vehemently. It's going to be very difficult to prove. I mean, I remember the cases involving Emre, the Newcastle player, not that long ago, actually, and it was extremely difficult to sort of take that further. You know, it's sort of difficult, really, to comment on this case while it's sort of going on, but. I think they'll find it very difficult. Evra has obviously been fairly outspoken already in what he said, so I presume that he'll kind of give further evidence, and then they'll have to take it from there. But if it's between two people on a football pitch and there's no evidence, I'm sure TV footage will be looked at, but it's going to be very difficult to push it.
We have to move on to Newcastle and Spurs on Sunday. Alison, you're probably Harry's biggest fan here, so I want to I want to start with this. Are you surprised? We talk about people playing guys in the right positions, or versus people getting creative and the whole inverted winger and whatever else. He starts the game with Gareth Bale on the right wing and Luka Modric wide left. Is this a solution? It obviously didn't work very well on the day, but
no. Well, I think this is probably all about a manager thinking, oh, well, they've got a really Ryan Taylor, really inexperienced left back. That's a real problem area for Newcastle. Let's go at it. And so he puts Bale on the right to do that. I don't think when you're Spurs and you're doing as well generally as Spurs are, you should think that way. I think that backfired horribly, actually. Ryan Taylor did very, very well. I mean, there was a point at which I was thinking, is he actually a left back? Wouldn't I have noticed that he's a left back? He really seems to be playing rather well in that position. And all it did was nullify the threat of Modric. Bale didn't really, you know, I think Bale was expecting to get more out of the game than he did, and I think that didn't do his confidence much good. So, I mean, I am assuming that was the logic behind it, and I think it did backfire slightly. I don't think you go to somewhere like Newcastle, and I mean, it's a big compliment to the way Newcastle have started this season, but I don't think if you're Spurs, you go there and you try and meddle with what you're very good at just to exploit what are the perceived weaknesses there.
George, can you clear this up for us? I mean, I appreciate, you know, Ryan Taylor isn't, Stuart Pearce and Paolo Maldini rolled into one, but if I remember correctly, the guy is a left-sided player, and he has to play a little bit further back and be a little more defensive. I mean, why is all of a sudden it makes it seem as if he's some kind of mannequin out there on the pitch?
Well, no, but Alisson's exactly right. I mean, Pardew said that afterwards as well. I mean, he thought that was exactly what that was about. Tottenham targeting what they viewed to be a weak link. I mean, I think that's a fair enough. I think that's a fair enough tactic if that's what they want to do. But Ryan Taylor isn't a left back. If Pardew got his way, and I don't mean this to be kind of negative, but you know, if Pardew and most people had got their way, Ryan Taylor wouldn't have started the season. But you know, he has done very well. He's been part of a very solid back five, and looks good. And it was another little feather in his cap that Bale had to move back across. Back across on the pitch.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Gareth Bale is the most dangerous direct left-sided player, one of the most dangerous in the world. So why play him on the right?
In fact, I should point out that, in fairness to Ryan Taylor, that he's played on the right side for most of his, for most of his career, and that's why he was signed.
Why I was asking, George, is that because I can see the point. I can remember, just trying to think who it was, played against Ashley Cole, played a left-sided right winger against Ashley Cole, because you take Ashley Cole onto his right foot, that should embarrass him more than trying to go outside him and letting him nick the ball off you with his left. I can see the point in that. But in the case of Ryan Taylor, it doesn't seem to add up.
George, you were at the game, dramatically equalizer for Newcastle. I thought Newcastle deserved it. But what I think is interesting is, you know, when we talk about how they can do this season, and whether they'll just sort of naturally move back down to mid-table, one thing that strikes me is they've started just 14 different players this season. Is this a case of Pardew overachieving, or is there more to come? Are there guys who maybe haven't featured, like Ben Arfa, who can come in and provide a lift when some of these guys start to flag?
Yeah, well, I thought when Ben Arfa came on yesterday, there was immediately sort of another dimension to the way they play. I mean, it wasn't sort of that he did a great deal, but you can just immediately see that he's giving Tottenham something completely different to think about. And as you know, we have to remember that he's been out for a year or so. So as he comes back.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
The four, I think he will add something very different. I mean, I think you just have to, at this stage, you just have to sort of take a step back and say well done to Pardew and say well done to the team. There was, you know, a bit of chaos hanging around over the summer. We shouldn't forget that. Joey Barton, players getting legal letters about Twitter, questioning the transfer policy, so on and so forth, not getting a striker over the line before the transfer deadline, and you know, here they are fourth on the table, playing really well and full of confidence. And some of that has been an organic process, starting the season well, going to Sunderland and winning, and that's just massive up here. And it's, you know, I think Sunderland have suffered in the same way that Newcastle have prospered from that game. But I think it's also right to say that Alan Pardew is a good manager and has managed them very, very well. He's had a bit of chance now to work on the defence. They look very solid. Yesterday's probably not the best example of that, but generally speaking, they do. And taking out people like Joey Barton, Kevin Nolan, Jose Enrique, whilst sort of painful for a lot of people at the time, has allowed new players to come in, express themselves more, breathe deeply, and, you know, we've got something else developing here. Whether it can last, I'm sure no Newcastle fan expects them to stay where they are, but they're playing some really good stuff. And I was sort of said at the end of the game yesterday to a couple of kind of colleagues, you know, it's actually enjoyable to come and watch football at St James's Park at the moment, and it hasn't always been the case in recent seasons. So, you know, well done to them, and long may it continue.
Two things on Pardew. I think I've been saying he's a potentially excellent manager ever since he was at West Ham, where I thought he did a tremendous job. That's one thing. The other thing about the rise of Newcastle, I mean, looking at their team list yesterday, you thought, yes. It's so familiar. And the way that allegedly better endowed clubs change their team all the time actually helps small squads. Fulham come to mind. They did the same thing under Roy Hodgson the season before last. 4-4-2, which is not bad, you know. It's not completely discredited, despite what people say in an England context. 4-4-2, same team. And it does provide, it does actually give you an edge against supposedly well-endowed teams who change the tactics and the personnel all the time.
Where do they get that audacious spirit from? I mean,
that's sort of open-ended question we'll have to get George back on for to ask. I was hoping to ask a Ledley King question because I'm getting a nasty look from my producer. So I will, Alison, you get it. It's going to be a very quick question and it's very simple. Harry comes out and says, Ledley King will get hurt and you don't know when he's going to get hurt because he never trains. If that's the case, does it make sense to start him and run the risk that he's just going to get crocked early in the game like he did at the weekend and then you just have to replace him and you lose a substitution?
No, I don't. I mean, it sounds cruel. It sounds cruel. Well, I think if the lad cannot train, it's going to happen.
I'm not a doctor. I've just never heard this.
No.
He cannot train, but he can play. It just seems, I don't know. It just seems.
It's been going on too long. It's been going on too long. And I don't really want to say it. It sounds very cruel, but I think put out to pasture is a good phrase and the right thing to do.
And I think he was a great player, and I think it would be a loss to not just to Spurs, but to the English game. In our debate this week, we maintain our theme from the Northeast, as we like to do when we're privileged. We have the privilege of having George join us. George, we're going to look at Sunderland. Now, I need you to explain this to me a little bit, because, you know, to me, obviously, living in London, you only hear things filtered through a certain type of through a certain type of media. And so Niall Quinn is the Sunderland chairman. And now he gets moved to a job where he's spearheading international development. I saw quotes from him where he said he was lucky that Ellis Short agreed to this plan. So does this mean it was Niall Quinn who said, I don't want to be chairman anymore. I want to spearhead international development. Ellis, you go be chairman. Is that what happened?
Well, that's only what Niall's saying, yeah. And, I mean, you know, we know that there's been a lot of rumours about Niall, about Sunderland this season, mainly, I think, stemming from the way things have gone on the pitch. But, yes, I mean, Niall had a five-year plan to sort of be, you know, to stay as chairman for that long when he got the job and then sort of move aside. And he has been pressing for Ellis Short to sort of engage more and more and more and more with the, you know, with the club. So this is all part of that. This is all part of that sort of process. I think.
So it's not a demotion. It's not because Sunderland make enormous losses year after year and whatever.
No,
and Ellis is tired of putting his money to giving his money to Bruce and Quinn. And
no,
that's not it.
No,
he's happy to keep doing it.
Short is incredibly supportive of Steve Bruce. You know, I keep kind of reading things, and Ellis Short won't be happy with the way things are going. Steve Bruce under pressure. Steve Bruce, of course, is under pressure. You know, as he should be, like every manager. But then that's not the kind of debate that they're sort of having. It's a tight knit group, and they're kind of supportive of each other. I don't think Quinn moving helps matters, or you know, stepping to one side helps matters, because he has been kind of a real rock and a real sort of certainty over the last sort of 5-6 years. You know, he's somebody who's capable of sort of articulating what being Sunderland means. He's somebody who can talk to supporters on a human and passionate level. And I think the fact that he's kind of moving into the shadows a little bit sort of will only sort of increase those uncertainties. But they're quick to point out that, you know, Niall will still be kind of heavily involved on the football side. He'll still be talking to Steve Bruce. They're all the same people as before. We're making the decisions at the club.
Sorry, I'm doing this from London here. Is this a club that has lost, what is it, £75 million over the last couple of seasons? I mean, I appreciate that, you know, that these are economic tough times and everything, but it seems to me that year after year they get by because Ellis Short writes a big check at the end of the season.
Yeah, but I mean,
now is this the best that you can hope for with Niall Quinn and by extension Steve Bruce around? I mean, it just seems to me, is this a team that's punching above its weight, or is it a team that's basically right where you expect it to be given the enormous amounts of money? And when Ellis Short decides to stop writing checks, they'll roll back to fighting to avoid relegation.
Well, I mean, that's a question you could ask of 90% of the clubs in the Premier League.
Well, no, 90% of clubs in the Premier League don't lose all the money that Sunderland lose every year.
Well, a lot of them do. Until the last year, Newcastle were losing 35 million quid a year. It'd be interesting to know, you know, how much teams like Stoke are having to write off. And, you know, Sunderland have got an owner who at the moment is prepared to do that. And all those debts are being recapitalised, so it's not owned back in big loans to him. Short's been
actually, George, I think we should highlight that because that's really important. I mean, some owners, Ellis Short writes a check to the club and it goes into equity at the end of the year. This isn't Sunderland accruing debt after year like some owners I can mention.
No, and that's an important thing. Now, does he want to be doing that year after year after year? No, I'm sure he doesn't. And if you look at Steve Bruce's transfer dealings, it's not really fair to say that he's been given countless millions of pounds to spend, because in actual fact he's brought back a hell of a lot of money. So but there's no doubt that if Sunderland want to progress and continue to progress, they're going to have to find other revenue streams, and that's part of what Niall Quinn is doing. Because just very briefly, I think Newcastle, for example, I'm putting this in a North East prism for obvious reasons, but Newcastle aren't just a Premier League club and a kind of English club. I think because of what happened under Kevin Keegan, they're still seen as a kind of international football club. Sunderland are very much seen as a Wearside football club and a North East football club. That's not disrespectful to them. That's just the way things have gone. And they've got to branch out and find revenue streams and find people who are prepared to buy shirts in the Far East and so on and so forth, and that's a big part of why Niall Quinn is in the position, you know, in the position that he is.
Paddy, on the back of what George said there, I mean, I think we can be in agreement that Sunderland aren't in this situation because of Steve Bruce overspending, although I think it's pretty obvious there was a lot of spending when Roy Keane was there. But that said, I mean, you know, George is talking about growing the club, finding other markets and so on. At some point, do you clash with the reality that this is a city of 280,000 people? They have a great stadium, but there's only so much you can do. And that if this club ever runs at break even, for all Niall Quinn's trips around the world to try to raise money, there is a certain reality that Sunderland will never be a top four club.
It's never going to have not in the foreseeable future can Sunderland have an international dimension. The extraordinary thing is that it does have a regional dimension. I mean, as you say, a city of 200,000 people, a little bit bigger than Ipswich, but a little bit like Ipswich. The people come from not just the sort of core community, but around and about. And George would be able to correct me if I'm wrong on that. But despite, you know, the competition from Middlesbrough and Newcastle. But I cannot see, you know, what you do have to get now if you really want to progress is that international dimension. I can't see Sunderland getting it. Why would anybody in Hong Kong want to support Sunderland? I mean, it's but that doesn't mean that they can't be a big club. I mean, a big-ish club. But what they've done, well, the great thing they've done is sort out the stadium, because a lot of people would love a 48,000.
And by the way, that was the previous regime. Correct me if I'm wrong here, George. I mean, this wasn't Niall Quinn's friends from the Drummondville people, those pub landlords and stuff.
No.
Named Paddy. This was the much maligned Bob Murray, yeah?
Yes.
The guy who got glassed in the face in the pub for his troubles, yeah?
Well, that's his legacy. That's his legacy to Sunderland, as is the training ground. I mean, and they'll be making announcements in the short term about what's happening at the training ground, and they've got development around the stadium that's going to be announced soon, and they're doing that. You know, they signed a Korean player over the summer. Steve Bruce, Niall Quinn, and others were in Korea during the international break, and you know they're kind of building up ties there, and it has to happen. I mean, if you compare the team between now and when they got promoted, it's unrecognisable. You know, the prospect of them being able to sign people like Wes Brown, John O'Shea 5 years ago simply wasn't there. So they've kind of developed. I know the results haven't been very good, but they've developed in terms of profile in England in that time.
The only thing I would say is that the team recruitment, but I disagree about recruitment policy. I think you want to buy players with something to prove. You want to buy players with resale value. You want to buy players with potential. And they've bought too many people who are in the comfort zone. It's you know, the Mal Brank, the Anton Ferdinand, the people like that. Well, they do need to get the character of the team right.
There's a dual dynamic there, though, because you know the likes of Ferdinand, Mal Brank, Cisse, Diouf, they did come when Sunderland were promoted under Roy Keane, and they couldn't get the players they wanted. They had to fast track that system. They spent far too much money getting people, some of whom with dodgy characters, and then it's been difficult for them to sort of get those people back out again and start again. I think they have reached a different situation now. If you look at their team all the way through last season, they were, for most of it, they rivaled Arsenal and possibly even were younger, had the youngest squad in the Premier League, the youngest starting 11 in the Premier League last season. That brought them a lot of benefits, but it also brought them some negatives, and that's what they've addressed, you know, this summer. They've also signed 11 players this summer, and it's going to take a while for them to bed in, but there's a kind of dual dynamic that's gone on there.
One final thing, he lives in London, doesn't he? Alice Short.
Yes, and he has done for many years. I mean, that's another thing. He keeps getting sort of, you know, he's getting more involved. He's coming over to this country to sort of sort things out. Well, he's always been involved. He's been party to all the big decisions over the last couple of years, and is based in London. So
have you ever seen him?
Yes, I've met him. I've shaken his hand and had a chat with him in the Sunderland boardroom.
Really? Is it a myth that he's incredibly private then?
No, I mean, he is a private man. He won't become the new Niall Quinn.
Or Mike Ashley.
But that parallel is fascinating about, you know, the difference between Sunderland and Newcastle. Sunderland have had Niall Quinn to sort of smooth things over. Nobody knows anything about Ellis Short. Nobody knows very much about Mike Ashley. But the way they presented themselves to their publics is... is kind of contrasting, and that's been a real strength for Sunderland over the past few years. So there is a definite different outlook to that football club, whether they like it or not.
All right, who's excited for some quick hits? I know Paddy is.
I am. Can't wait.
Quick reminder, I will ask a question. You will have 25 seconds to answer. If you do not answer in the allotted time, I will come down on you very hard. Robin van Persie scores twice as Arsenal defeats Sunderland, rising to 10th in the table. And the Dutchman tells fans not to believe the lies in the newspapers because he's committed to the cause. But Paddy, the truth of the matter is that if he doesn't extend his contract, he becomes a free agent in June. Should van Persie be doing less talking and more signing?
I think van Persie has been a credit to himself and Arsenal. I think he's entitled to take a little bit of time. He's got the same problem as, a more acute version of the same problem as the rest of us with Arsenal. He just can't be sure where it's going. I think we'll give him until Christmas before we start accusing him of anything.
Wolves started the season brightly, but after the 2-0 defeat in the big derby against West Brom, have now lost 5 in a row. George, Mick McCarthy used to work in your part of the world. What's wrong with Wolves?
I've got no idea. So I asked on Twitter, and David Johnson, a Wolves fan, tells me that Wolves are too open when they play 4-4-2 and don't look like scoring when they play 4-5-1, and none of their big players are playing well.
There you go. Not short and sweet. Staying with that match, Paul Scharner displayed a T-shirt with a big West Brom crest on it. This upset both McCarthy, who complained about it after the game, and the lovable Stephen Hunt, who allegedly waited in the tunnel after the match. Allison, did Scharner break some newfangled footballer's code, of which I'm aware, or should Hunt and McCarthy chill out?
I think it's rather lovely if your children paint you a T-shirt that you show it off.
You're going to sell for charity too.
That's even better. There's an interview in the Times today with Shelley Wood, who's a wheelchair racer, and she broke her back when she was 11, and she said she never got upset about being in a wheelchair. She'd get upset about very small things in life, and she realised as she got older she was really upset about the big thing but didn't know how to voice it. And I suspect McCarthy and Hunt are just very cross at the way Wolves are going at the moment, but are focusing on a rather small thing.
Dr. Rudd psychoanalyzing Stephen Hunt. I think lots to get into there. Roberto Mancini dusts off his second string strike force and does rather well, as Adam Johnson, Mario Balotelli, and James Milner all score in City's 4-1 win over Villa, which sees City go top of the table. Paddy, which of these three guys is going to play the biggest role between now and the end of the season?
Hard to say, because they're all so different, but I do feel that if Mario Balotelli plays a major role in the rest of this season, then Manchester City are going to be well nigh uncatchable. He's turning into a formidable, formidable player. And he could well be a champion at the end of this season.
There you go. And he's proving all those haters wrong. QPR draw 1-1 at home with Blackburn, and Joey Barton has a go at Adel Taarabt. He allegedly says, quote, "They told me he was a genius. I haven't seen it." George, is this a case of Barton relaying some tough love to his teammate, or is it Barton just being disruptive and annoying and Pratt-like?
Well, it's Joey Barton, so it's a bit of everything. We're not talking about the most straightforward individual, talking about an individual who is also not straightforward. So one replaced the other as captain. This is Joey being Joey, expressing an opinion. I think there's probably some validity to his opinion, but then some of those things have also applied to himself in the past, haven't they?
So they have. Chelsea break their poor run against Davy Moyes' Everton with a 3-1 win. Alison, you were there. Did you see anything that makes you think they can challenge for the title?
Yeah, I did. I think they will, because I think they can. Chelsea can so clearly be better than they are at the moment. They are, it's curious to say it, but they do feel like a work in progress. The manager wants them to win in style. I mean, that's always the remit from Abramovich, I suppose. But I do sense they're still fitting it all together and still getting the results. And when that happens, and you've got the resources a club like Chelsea have got, they can only challenge from the title from that point.
When I own a football club, I'm going to order my players to win ugly with no style whatsoever.
Gab, one for you. I was going to ask you to explain the phenomenon that is Levante, but in Spain, it has to be Barca. They beat Racing Santander 3-0, with Messi scoring twice, giving him 103, by my reckoning, in the last 100 games at the club. Gab, would Messi score as many if he didn't play for Barcelona? Have you played for another club?
Well, it depends what club it is. My guess is probably not, simply because you are helped by having great players around you and dominating games. What is remarkable about Messi is, certainly compared to Ronaldo, how few of his goals are the result of individual efforts. I actually think on a bad team, I think Ronaldo would probably continue scoring just as much. Messi would have to dial it down a little bit. And as for Levante, well, they are a subject of an upcoming column of mine, so you can stay tuned and read all about that.
I will, baby.
So we've got time for this week. You can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, your web chats. Paddy's is every Monday. Mine is every Tuesday. You got Ollie K at some point during the week as well. Please drop in. It's worth it. And also, we've got our live show coming up. It's October 27th. You can find out about it on the website. Thanks for spending your time with us. Until next week. Bye-bye.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.